Hi, everybody. This is More, the Management of Reality. This is our English language podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about Trump's quote-unquote peace plan for Gaza and what that means, because Hamas is already violating the peace plan, I mean, the terms it agreed to in the peace plan, and neither Trump nor Netanyahu seem to be doing anything about it. So why not? And so that's what we're going to talk about today. I think I'll start us off with a piece of news from yesterday. I'm going to put it on the screen. Allow me. So it was reported yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, as you can see, that Hamas has calculated it can survive in Gaza in rule. The militant group is challenging demands that it be dismantled ahead of key talks on Trump's peace plan. That's October 23rd, all right? That's yesterday. Now, this is not the first indication that we've had that Hamas has no intention to disarm. It's just the latest. The messaging from Hamas has been very consistent. They even killed two Israeli soldiers recently, which prompted a retaliation from the IDF. They bombed some Hamas positions and so forth. Now, this is something that we predicted when the peace plan was announced. I said that you remember that, Yoel, right?
Yes.
We were very clear about this. We said that our prediction was first that the first phase of the plan, yes, Hamas would comply with that, because the first phase of the plan was that they had to turn over the live hostages and also the dead hostages. I was uncertain about the dead hostages because I'm not even sure they can find them all. But the live hostages, I was sure that they were going to, or I was reasonably sure that they were going to turn them all over, because if they didn't hand over the hostages, then Trump cannot protect Hamas. And my model is precisely that Trump is in the business of protecting the jihadis. He has a pro-jihadi and anti-Israeli policy, okay? Trump, like his predecessors in the White House, is trying to destroy the Jewish state in genocide. This is our model. So the prediction was, well, Hamas will definitely turn over the live hostages, because if they don't, then there's no way to stop the Israelis from returning to the charge against Hamas, and Trump won't be able to protect Hamas, right? So that part had to be done. But after that, we predicted pretty much everything that is in stipulated in Trump's peace plan as an obligation of Hamas under the terms of the plan would be violated by Hamas. That was our prediction. And the most important provisions in the plan, of course, are that Hamas should disarm and that Hamas should step down from any role in the government of Gaza. And what the Wall Street Journal is now saying, which is only the latest, because as we said, the Hamas messaging on this has been very consistent, is that no, they don't intend to disarm and they don't intend to give up the government of Gaza. And therefore, we should, if you're an innocent person and an innocent, someone who just was born yesterday, you would think, well, then Trump and Netanyahu are going to go back into war and disarm Hamas. Why would you think that? Well, because being an innocent person who was born yesterday, you are paying attention to what these people say. And Trump has been saying repeatedly that if Hamas doesn't disarm, he's going to go disarm them. And he makes his usual very, histrionic threats, sounding very macho, just like he did.
I have it here, Francisco.
Go ahead. Let's see it.
If you want me to show you.
Yeah, let's see the threats.
This is a tweet that Donald recently posted, 16th of October. If Hamas continues to kill people in Gaza, which was not the deal, we will have no choice but to go in and kill them. Thank you for your attention to this matter.
Thank you. Thank you for your attention to this matter. I love it. Yeah, he sounds like he almost sounds like a flight attendant, you know, telling yes. people to buckle their seatbelts or some nonsense like that. So he's going to go in and kill them if they don't stop killing people in Gaza. But in fact, what happened? Almost immediately, Hamas started executing Arab Palestinians in Gaza. And Trump publicly apologized for this, interpreting the extrajudicial murders of Arab Palestinians in Gaza, who, as I understand, are Arab Palestinians belonging to the clans that are enemies of Hamas, right? And that have been fighting Hamas. Trump publicly apologized for these extrajudicial murders by saying that Hamas is supposedly mopping up a criminal element in Gaza. Now, to put this in context so that people understand exactly what Trump is doing, you have to remember that Hamas is not merely a terrorist organization. It is a terrorist organization that carried out the biggest terrorist attack against the Jewish people since the Holocaust. The horrific massacre of October 7th, 2023. And also that Hamas is officially recognized as a terrorist organization by the US State Department. So Trump's own government recognizes Hamas as a terrorist organization, which is of course why Hamas in the peace plan is supposed to disarm and give up the government of Gaza, right? And yet when these terrorists, these unspeakable terrorists, start executing Arab Palestinians in Gaza, Trump's response is to apologize for them as supposedly conducting a police action. Well, excuse me, but there's no such thing as a police action that includes extrajudicial murders in the streets. That's not a police action at all. That's terrorism, okay? This is what terrorists do. They're behaving like the terrorists that they've always been. So it is in fact diagnostic of what is really going on to see the President of the United States apologizing for these terrorists when in fact these terrorists have given him a golden excuse to go in and destroy them like he promised that he would do, right? So first he makes these, you know, exaggerated threats about how macho he is and how he's going to kill anybody who dares defy him and so on and so forth. And the minute they do this, he starts apologizing for them, right? Which also demonstrates that they don't care about the Arab Palestinians. They don't care about the Arab Palestinians at all. They care about protecting Hamas and about injuring the security of the Jewish state. You wanted to say something?
Yes, I want just to share my personal experience with that exact tweet that I show you, that I saw that and I said, wow, like, I really believe that. And I saw like, wow, like he's going like in and
believed it?
Yeah, for a second, yes, but hear me out. I send it to my brother and he responded me, yeah, Joel, he's saying this from January. Like, he's been saying this like for months. and again, I see your model. So, yeah.
Once again, you recognize the superiority of my model. Is that right?
Yeah.
Say it.
Yeah. Like, my brother's response was like, no, but it's like Francisco said, like the model.
Okay, so your brother has more faith in my model than you do. I think I'm going to have to fire you and hire your brother. Okay, so anyway, now notice when we are bragging about the superiority of the Moore model, we have to point out how consistent it accounts for Trump's behavior, because what we just saw, which is Trump, you know, blustering, theatrically about how macho he is and making threats and so forth. And then when the conditions that would trigger the behavior that he threatened he would set in motion happen, right? When those conditions take place, he doesn't do anything, right? Well, that structure is exactly the same as what we saw with Iran. So a few months ago, when when Israel was attacking Iran, right? And we were perhaps a few hours away from the destruction of the Ayatollah regime in Iran, right? Because the Iranians had no air defenses left and the Israelis were operating freely over Iranian airspace. Trump came in and saved them at the last moment, just like he saved Hamas in Gaza. Same structure, right? The Israelis were about to destroy, you know, give the coup de grace to Hamas in Gaza because they were now attacking the last strongholds that Hamas had in Gaza, right? So Trump sweeps in, imposes a ceasefire, right? In the same way that in Iran, when Israel was about to destroy the Iranian regime, I mean, the Iranian regime could no longer defend itself. They had no air defenses. So if Israel had continued pummeling Iran, it was all over for the Ayatollahs. So what did Trump do? First of all, he announced on Truth Social that he wanted to save the Iranian empire. Okay? He said it like that. And then he dropped a few bombs. When the Ayatollahs did not comply with his dramatic request that they come back to negotiate, that they, you know, raise the white flag and come back to negotiations so that he could save them, right? So that he could stop the Israelis. The Iranians didn't do that because they couldn't, because their internal structure and ideology and discourse is that Israel is Satan. And so and the entire purpose of the Iranian jihadi terrorist state is the destruction, the genocidal destruction of the Jewish state, right? That's the entire purpose of the Iranian theocratic jihadi terrorist state. So under attack from Israel, they can't raise the white flag. They can't do it. So even though Trump was begging them to do so that he could stop the Israelis, it couldn't happen. So what Trump did was he dropped a few bombs on some Iranian positions, almost nothing, in just one night. And then immediately he said, all right, that's it. We succeeded. We've allegedly destroyed the Iranian nuclear program, right? Which now everybody says is not really true. You know, almost all the experts have said that no, Trump probably didn't destroy it. But anyway, he declared that it was a massive success and it was all over. And therefore, the war was over. And now he imposed a ceasefire on the Israelis, right? So the interpretation we give to that is that Trump came into the war against Iran only so that he could stop the Israelis. All right. Now, what is the strongest dramatic diagnostic fact that supports this interpretation? It's the threats. Okay, because just as Trump has threatened Hamas in Gaza, you know, that he's going to go kill them and so forth if they don't obey, Trump did the same thing after dropping bombs on Iran. The thing he did immediately after dropping those bombs is that in all caps, in all capital letters, in his Truth Social, network, and people can go check this. He said, if Iran dares to retaliate against the United States, we're gonna destroy you. We're gonna come at you way worse than we did last night. You know, it's gonna be the end.
Yeah.
And then what happened? Iran did retaliate. It retaliated against U.S. positions in Qatar and in Iraq, again, because they couldn't help themselves. Because if they don't, can you imagine the entire pyramid in Iran is composed, except for the very top, it's composed of people who are innocent jihadis. That's a strange way of putting it, but they're jihadis who don't know anything except that they're jihadis. They don't understand geopolitics. They don't understand the deals that the Ayatollahs and the U.S. government probably make behind the scenes and so forth. They honestly believe that the Ayatollahs and the U.S. government are the worst enemies, right? So if the Ayatollahs had not replied, they were going to look like pussies to the entire Iranian structure, and that would have imperiled their grasp on power, their grip on power. Okay, so they had to throw something in reply, right? So they did it very carefully. They told the American government that the missiles were coming. They gave them time to get out of the way and so on and so forth. But they dropped a few missiles on U.S. positions. And therefore, the condition for Trump's threat materialized. Okay, he said, if you reply, we will go at you way worse than we did last night. That's what he had said in all caps, right? What happened? Trump did nothing. He didn't move. Okay, now, what is that consistent with? Well, it's consistent with the view that Trump's real purpose was to stop the Israelis from destroying the Ayatollah regime in Iran. Because if Trump had not stood put after the Iranians replied, then he would have had to, you know, he would have renewed bombing of Iran. And of course, then Israel can renew bombing of Iran, and it's all over for the Ayatollahs. So he had to stay put in order to keep the ceasefire on Israel, right? So what he did is, well, okay, they dropped a few missiles on me, but that's it. They won't do any more, and we're, you know, the war is still over. It's all consistent with the model that says that Trump's real purpose is to protect jihadism. And you see this pattern all over. It's important to go around, you know, to look at all the borders of Israel, because this is happening all around Israel. So in Lebanon, Trump forced the Israelis to stop. So they were advancing in Lebanon, destroying Hezbollah. They could have gone all the way to the north of Lebanon and liberated all of Lebanon, right? Hezbollah was not going to be able to stop them. But what Trump did is he forced the Israelis to move back. He forced the ceasefire, forced them to move back, and he created an agreement in which Israel stops firing on Hezbollah, and then the Lebanese army is supposedly responsible for demilitarizing the south of Lebanon and removing Hezbollah positions in the south of Lebanon. Now, this has not happened. There's a recent article that says, I'll see if I can find it, that says that Hezbollah is rearming faster than the Lebanese army can disarm them, right? Which simply means that, well, I can't find it right now, but if you put this into ChatGPT or even into Google, you'll find it in a second. Okay, so what's happening in the south of Lebanon is that, no, Hezbollah is not disarming. And in fact, nobody should have ever expected that the Lebanese army was going to disarm Hezbollah, because for a long time now, Hezbollah has been the real power in Lebanon. And in fact, the Lebanese army is an appendage of Hezbollah. They don't do anything against Hezbollah. To the contrary, Hezbollah has infiltrated not only the government of Lebanon, but of course the armed forces of Lebanon. So of course, what is happening in Lebanon is that Hezbollah is quickly rearming, and soon it'll be back to its original strength. Now, what happened in, you wanted to say something, go ahead.
Yes, at the end of the day, Francisco, Trump cannot do anything, right? Like Netanyahu was the one who gives him the power, right? Because he can tell him no, and Israel has sovereignty, and they can do whatever they want. So when you said like Trump forced force Israel, like
that's true. You're making a good point. The fact that Netanyahu obeys Trump means that there is a master-slave relationship between Trump and Netanyahu, because there's no, it doesn't make any sense to say that Trump can give orders to Netanyahu. Israel is supposed to be a sovereign state. So if Trump gives orders to Netanyahu that are against the security of the Israeli state, of course Netanyahu should just say, go fuck yourself, and I'm going to do whatever I want, right? That's what Netanyahu should do if he was an Israeli patriot, which he, of course, is not. So I accept your point. But still, what I'm trying to explain here are the intentions of the U.S. government, right? Yes. So you're right. The relationship is a master-slave relationship. But what Trump's orders to Netanyahu show is what Trump actually wants to achieve in the Middle East, right? So he forces... Okay. Well, he doesn't force, you're right, he doesn't force, but he orders his slave Netanyahu to draw back Israeli forces in Lebanon, and this allows Hezbollah to rearm. But not only that, everybody should know that the U.S. government is sending billions of dollars in armament to the Lebanese army, which is an appendage of Hezbollah, and it has been for a long time, and the U.S. has been sending all of that time, the U.S. has been sending billions of dollars in armament to the Lebanese army, which is strengthening Hezbollah, right? It's strengthening Hezbollah. So that's Lebanon. Now let's consider Syria. Same thing happened in Syria, but Syria is especially dramatic because in Syria, you have a government now which is the government of this guy al-Shara or al-Jolani, however you want to call him, who is the leader of Jabhat al-Nusra. Now, Jabhat al-Nusra never became formally a part of ISIS, but it did fight with ISIS, in alliance with ISIS for a long time, and it almost merged with ISIS. The only reason it didn't merge with ISIS is that this guy al-Jolani didn't want to be under orders from somebody else. He didn't want al-Baghdadi, who was the leader of ISIS, to be his boss, right? So that's the only reason they didn't merge. But it's not as if they have ideological differences. They both came out of the same ideological mix of the war in Iraq and Syria, and they always agreed with ISIS, and that's why they almost merged with ISIS. So basically, this is ISIS. That's what it is. It's really ISIS. So notice Trump not only ordered his slave Netanyahu to draw his forces back on Syria, which Netanyahu did. Trump basically recognized this ISIS government in Syria. Okay? He met in person with al-Jolani in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Isn't that amazing? They met, they shook hands, and Trump implicitly recognized al-Jolani's government as the new legitimate government in Syria, which was made dramatic by the fact that Trump lifted sanctions on Syria. Okay, so there were sanctions on Syria because Bashar al-Assad was supposedly this big monster. And so there were all these sanctions imposed on Syria, right? Now Bashar al-Assad is gone and this guy al-Jolani comes in. Trump goes shake his hand in Riyadh and then he lifts sanctions on Syria, signaling that al-Jolani is a good guy. Now, why is this so unbelievably dramatic? Because Trump, in his first government, bragged that he had defeated ISIS. Of course, he didn't defeat ISIS, but he bragged that he had. He paraded himself as the great destroyer of ISIS. ISIS was supposed to be Trump's big enemy, big nemesis, right?
Mm.
And now he is installing an ISIS government in Syria.
Mm.
It's really, I mean, you can hardly get a more diagnostic fact than this. Trump is pro-jihadism. He's a protector of jihadism. That's what he's doing. You want to say something?
Yeah, it comes to mind when you said that, Ronald Reagan with Iran, right? Like, he's a big opponent here, a big enemy. And the first thing he did when he just came to the office was what you documented on that.
Excellent. Excellent. You are now using historical evidence to identify patterns. And this is precisely what we have to do. So I congratulate you. This is exactly what happened with Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan pretended to be the biggest enemy of Iran, right? Just like Trump pretended to be the biggest enemy of ISIS, right? And in Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign, which is 1979 is when the presidential campaign is going on, right? His rival was incumbent President Jimmy Carter, right? And all throughout the presidential campaign, Ronald Reagan kept saying that Carter was a pussy and he wouldn't stand up properly to Ronald Reagan, and he didn't have the guts to really confront Iran and so on and so forth, but he would do it. You know, Ronald Reagan said, I'm going to confront Iran, and no, Iran is not going to, you know, make fun of the United States. It's no longer going to humiliate the United States and so on and so forth. I'm going to show them, blah, blah, blah. That was the big, the most dramatic aspect of Ronald Reagan's campaign, was his foreign policy promises to really stand up to Iran. Now, the minute Ronald Reagan was inaugurated, he started sending in secret billions of dollars in weapons to Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, right? He behaved like an Iranian mole in the White House. He committed treason. He committed treason because he was violating U.S. law in order to send billions of dollars in armament to a terrorist regime that in public claimed to, that in public promised to destroy the United States. So that's treason. That's treason, right? And Reagan did all of that, as you pointed out correctly, after bragging that he was Iran's biggest enemy. So we have the exact same structure. They brag that they're the worst enemy of the jihadis, but in practice, what do? They support the growth and strength of the jihadis. And I'm going to make another point here. The birth of ISIS, and we have an article about that, so let me put it up on the screen. Let me see, where do I have that? I'm very glad that you reminded me of this, but I just realized. Okay, here we go. So what most people don't understand is that ISIS is actually a creation of the U.S. government. That sounds like a crazy thing to say, right? But this was actually documented in the mainstream press. It's not like this is something that I'm contributing for the first time. No. This was documented in the New York Times and in the Washington Post and in other places. Of course, they present it as a mistake, right? They present, they screwed up, blah, blah, blah. But in fact, ISIS is a consequence of the system of military prisons in Iraq created by the U.S. government. So what happened was that after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, or during the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the U.S. military created these gigantic prisons. We're looking at Camp Buka here. There's another very big one called Camp Cropper. They created these gigantic prisons to put in there all of these jihadis who were doing suicide bombings and so forth all over Iraq, who of course were not doing that when Saddam Hussein was running Iraq, right? That started happening after the US invaded. And they also put a lot of innocent people in these prisons, or at any rate, people who were not jihadis, right? And the people running these, the military, the US military running these giant prisons were allowing the jihadis to control the social life of the prisons. And they would allow the jihadis to teach the principles of jihad to the people who were not yet jihadis and to force them into jihadism, okay? Because these terrorists had the control of social life inside the prison, and they were the officers running the prison were allowing these jihadis to teach with blackboards, to teach them how to make bombs, the principles of jihad, how to become a suicide bomber, and all this stuff. And they were forcing all of the people who were not yet jihadists into the jihadi system, recruiting them forcibly. And ISIS, all of the leaders of ISIS came out of this. This is where ISIS was born. Now, these huge military prisons in Iraq were operating for 5 years. 5 years, okay? And at the end of 5 years, now I have to say, even the general in charge of these military prisons recognized what was going on. He called his prison system Jihadi University. That was his phrase. Okay, the general in charge of these prisons called the prison system Jihadi University, recognizing that what was going on in there is that everybody in the prison was becoming a jihadist because he was allowing it. All right, so there was 5 years of this, and at the end of 5 years, you know, the time it takes to get a bachelor's degree in jihadism, at the end of those 5 years, the U.S. authorities simply dismantled the prison system, and they let everybody out. They let everybody out. This was reported in the mainstream press. The Iraqi sheikhs, you know, the clan leaders in Iraq were outraged by this. They were outraged. They were complaining to the U.S. authorities, wait a minute, what are you doing? Those prisons are full of Al-Qaeda in Iraq terrorists. You can't just release them. And the Iraqi government in Baghdad, mind you, the Iraqi government that the US had installed in Baghdad, okay? Hmm. Even that government was complaining to the US authorities about what they were doing. They were wait a minute, what are you doing? If you're not gonna hold these people, give us the intelligence on these people, so that we know who they are and what crimes they committed and so on, and we'll hold them. We will put them in prison, but don't release them.
Wow.
And they couldn't get the U.S. authorities to agree. They just closed down the prison system and they let everybody out. And Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is what was inside these prisons, that's what became ISIS, okay? So ISIS is a product of US policy, and it looks like deliberate US policy. And now you see what they're doing now. They're legitimizing ISIS as the government of Syria. Okay? They're legit. Now, why did they ever fight ISIS? Why did they ever fight ISIS? We explained that in the article as well. Fighting ISIS, ISIS was, of course, the most horrible thing anybody had ever seen, right? They were beheading people and making videos of the beheadings and putting them on social media and so forth. Before the Gaza attack on innocent Israelis, nobody had seen anything quite so horrific as ISIS. So those images of horror became the justification for a military alliance between the US and Iran. Okay, so the story they told us is, you know, ISIS is even worse than Iran, so we have to ally with Iran to destroy ISIS. Okay, and this is what they always do.
Yes,
depending on the year, they're telling you that the Sunnis are worse than the Shiites, and if you wait another year, they're going to tell you that the Shiites are worse than the Sunnis. So they're always allying with one against the other, but the effect of these movements is always to produce a geopolitical consequence that is bad for Israel. So what happened there is that they told us, you know, ISIS is worse than Iran, so we need Iran to help us defeat ISIS. And indeed, that's what happened. Iran attacked from the east, and the U.S. attacked from its bases in Iraq, and so on and so forth. And the consequence of that was that a corridor was opened for Iran all the way to the northern border of Israel, because once Iranian troops were allowed into Iraq under this excuse, you had full control. Iran developed full control of Iraq and acquired a land corridor all the way to the northern border of Israel, because Iran already controlled Syria, and it already, through its alliance with the al-Assad family, and it already controlled Lebanon thanks to Hezbollah. Okay, so that's what they did. And now we are seeing that because the axis, the Iranian axis, was disrupted in these last 2 years, as Israel was, you know, killing the entire Hezbollah leadership, and as Syria became a mess, and Israel moved into southern Syria and so forth, the Iranian axis that goes from Iran through Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon all the way, you know, to the northern border of Israel, that was disrupted. So what they did is they switched from the Iranian axis to the Turkish axis, because the main patrons of ISIS and al-Nusra and all these terrorists that operate in Syria is Turkey. Okay, so Iran is now very weakened. It's very difficult for Iran to help as much as they were before their proxies. And Iran is probably about to collapse, because they have a tremendous water crisis that is about to explode in their faces. So if Iran can no longer handle this, you need someone else to step in, and that someone else is Turkey. So now, instead of having an east-west axis to attack Israel, they have a north-south axis from Turkey into Syria, with Turkey supporting the new ISIS government in Syria. That's what they're doing, because Turkey has been the patron of these al-Nusra and ISIS terrorists in Syria. And this is all U.S. policy. This is all U.S. policy, right? Mm-hmm. So we covered Lebanon. Oh, I'm sorry, you have a question?
No. So, like, you are displaying to us, like, the entire picture, right, for the last 40 years or so?
No. This is the last 2 years. The last 2 years. Well, we talked about Reagan, which takes us back. Yeah, you're right.
And Iraq,
yeah,
also.
And the invasion of Iraq. Forgive me. You're right.
So, like, we see this repeated cycle of, like, creating enemies and then saying that we are against the enemy, and, like,
yes, the policy has been very consistent. The interpretation of this policy in the mainstream media has always been that U.S. policymakers are making mistakes. Okay, so the interpretation they always give you is, oh, you know, they fucked up.
Yeah,
they don't understand the Middle East. They don't know what they're doing. They're idiots. They're too arrogant, blah, 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 blah. But the hypothesis that says that they're making mistakes because they're idiots cannot predict cannot explain. Well, first of all, it will not predict that the mistakes always go in the same direction. Stupidity has no particular direction. Okay. So you should be making mistakes in all kinds of directions if you're just an idiot, but the mistakes are always in the exact same direction, right? They spend Every time they direct policy in the Middle East and they spend billions of dollars in trying to change geopolitical reality in the Middle East, right? The consequence is always pro-jihadi and anti-Israel, right? So the mistakes were made hypothesis cannot explain what has actually been happening. If you're always making mistakes in the same direction, right? If people are always making mistakes in the same direction, you should suspect that they're not mistakes, that the mistakes were made claim is just a cover for what they actually want to achieve. And here, that hypothesis is very attractive because the overwhelming majority of the U.S. population does not want their own government promoting jihadism around the world. That's not what ordinary Americans want. So the U.S. government cannot say to the U.S. citizenry, this is what we want. This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to make jihadism grow all over the place and destroy Israel and invade Europe and invade the United States. They can't say that to American citizens. So when, as you say, 40 plus years of policy are consistently always making jihadism stronger, right? The explanation they have to give to the U.S. citizenry is that they're making mistakes, because that's the only explanation that U.S. citizens could accept for this sequence of policies, right? If U.S. citizens, if tomorrow, Saturday, if tomorrow U.S. citizens everywhere, all over the United States, were suddenly to conclude that jihadism has been the policy of all of their governments over a period of more than 40 years, there would be a revolution in the United States. There would be a revolution. So they can't say that, and therefore the only option is to say, we're idiots. We're idiots. But this is never the model that says that the most powerful people in all of recorded human history are idiots. That's not a reasonable model, because you're faced with a new paradox when you say that. You're saying that somehow people who can't even tie their shoes are the most powerful people ever. Well, if they're such imbeciles, how did they get so powerful? How do they keep their power? Right? That makes zero sense. So the hypothesis that does make sense is that these people are evil. In other words, they do not share our values. They're not Democrats. They're not interested in human dignity. They're not interested in human rights and modern democracy or anything like that. They're interested in power, and they've decided that the way to destroy democracy and increase their own power is to get these jihadis to destroy our Western countries, right? For a lot of people, the evidence is becoming overwhelming that this is what's going on. I mean, I've been saying it for 20 years. When I started saying this over 20 years ago, it was very confusing to a lot of people. But lately, it's becoming a lot clearer because so many dramatic things are happening now that people are having trouble reconciling with the mistakes were made model.
Yes, recently something happened that awakened a lot of people. I want to show you, maybe you saw this, Francisco. And shoot here. Put it like this. And Trump says that Israel is not going to do anything with the West Bank. After annexation.
Yeah, let's give them the context first. Yes. So recently in the Israeli Knesset, there was a narrow vote in favor of annexing Judea and Samaria, which is what the mainstream media calls the West Bank, which is a made up name. Of course, it would be a good thing for Israel to annex Judea and Samaria, because then over the entire territory of Judea and Samaria, then you have Israeli law being the law of the land, and then you can crack down on these jihadi terrorists who are paying Arab Palestinians to murder Jews, right? So the Palestinian Authority, Al-Fatah, which we now call the Palestinian Authority, has a program to pay ordinary Arab Palestinians in the disputed territories who kill Jews. Okay, so if you kill a Jew, you get a lifetime salary. And in fact, recently it was reported that some of the people coming out of the Israeli jails right now with the latest quote unquote peace plan, Trump's peace plan, some of the people coming out of Israeli jails are millionaires from this pay for slave program, as they call it. Okay, so obviously annexing Judea and Samaria would be a good thing, because the Palestinian Authority is a Jew killing machine. And in fact, yes, the pay for slave program, this program to pay people to kill Jews, it's a huge chunk of the Palestinian Authority budget. Okay, because they're very faithful to these Jew killers. Even if you die in the attempt of killing a Jew, they still pay you the salary. It goes to your family. And if you are arrested, they keep paying the salary. It doesn't matter. And that's why some of these people coming out of the Israeli jails are millionaires.
It's the number one way to make money by far.
That's true. Okay. It's the most important economic activity is killing Jews. And so what you're pointing out is very important, because there was a narrow vote in the Knesset in favor of annexing. It's non-binding, but it's in favor of annexing Judea and Samaria. And Trump is saying that he's not going to allow it, right? Because he knows that he's the master and that Netanyahu is his slave. So he says, no, I'm not going to allow this. I don't care what the Knesset does, meaning I don't care what the democratically elected representatives of the Israelis do. Wow. Right? That's what he's saying. Yeah. He's saying, I don't give a damn about Israeli democracy or the wishes of Israelis or what the democratically elected representatives of Israelis vote for. I am the master. I am the Pope, and Israel is my ghetto. That's what he's saying. He's saying, I am the Pope, and Israel is my ghetto. That's what Trump is saying. And if Israelis don't wake up to this, they're doomed.
And at the same time, he's saying, let's give Hamas a chance for peace. Yeah. They're breaking some rules here, but at the same time.
That's right. He's saying that if Hamas does not disarm, he's going to go disarm them. But there's no deadline. There's no deadline. So he can just keep pushing this back. Well, we're gonna see. We're gonna give them a chance. Let's wait another week. Let's wait another month. Let's see. And meanwhile, Hamas is making facts on the ground that make it harder and harder and harder for the IDF to defeat and disarm them, right? And kill them. So clearly, the policy is to assist the jihadis, but we haven't gone around the whole way. So let's keep going. So what else is around Israel? Well, just beyond Jordan. On the border you have Jordan, which has been armed by the United States as a reward for signing a meaningless peace agreement with Israel, right? So the United States government has been arming Jordan, the Kingdom of Jordan. And beyond Jordan is Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, which is becoming a patron of the al-Jolani government in Syria, and has been a patron of international jihadism for the longest time. They've been one of the most important patrons of international jihadism, right? They are the biggest consumers of U.S. weaponry in the entire world. Nobody gets more U.S. weapons of any state in the entire planet than Saudi Arabia. Okay? Now, they've never fought a war except for a few skirmishes with the Yemeni Houthis, which they've lost. Saudi Arabia hasn't done very well against the Houthis. But But other than that, they have no combat experience. But you should still worry that in an all-out assault of all of Israel's enemies against Israel, the tremendous hardware that the Saudis have been buying is definitely a factor. It's a factor, right? And now they're getting the green light from the U.S. for a nuclear program. Okay, so that's going on. What about Iraq? Well, the U.S. invasion of Iraq turned Iraq into the westernmost province of Iran. Okay, so Iran has been controlling Iraq for a long time now, and the U.S. government has under the fiction that Iraq is independent, which of course it's not, it's under the sway of Iran, but under the fiction that Iraq is independent, the U.S. government has been sending billions of dollars in armament to Iraq. So they've been arming the Iranians, basically. That's what they've been doing. And then you have, in the southern border, you have Egypt. Also as a reward of signing a meaningless peace agreement with Israel, this one in 1979, this is the Camp David Accord, the U.S. government has been arming Egypt to the teeth. It gives Egypt something like $2 billion in armament every year to Egypt, okay? Egypt, according to the peace agreement signed in 1979, is supposed to keep the Sinai demilitarized. Well, that's no longer true. Egypt has flooded the Sinai with its own troops, and it is conducting military exercises in the Sinai, obviously designed to launch an invasion of Israel. That's an act of war. That's an act of war, which of course Israel has not responded to because Trump doesn't want them to. And so all around Israel, what we see, and then Turkey, Trump is very, very friendly with Turkey, whose president, Erdogan, has publicly said that he's going to destroy Israel. He's recently been saying this out loud. And finally, there's Qatar, right? Qatar is the country that attacked Israel on October 7th. Because Qatar is a patron of Hamas. And Qatar, I think, in the last few years has sent something like, what is it? I can't really, it was a gigantic quantity of dollars to Qatar. I forget the exact figure, but they've been funding, of course, the development of Qatar's terrorist infrastructure, Hamas's terrorist infrastructure in Gaza. They've been hosting the leaders of Hamas in Qatar. They've been negotiating on behalf of Hamas. There's no ambiguity here. Qatar attacked Israel on October 7th. Okay. Hamas is simultaneously a Qatari and the Iranian proxy. So once again, we see the same pattern because Trump is the best friend of Qatar. So and not only Trump, I mean, this is a policy that goes back to Clinton. Clinton, in 1996, is the guy who had the Qataris build the Al Udeid base so that the United States could park Central Command in Qatar. Okay, so, the Al Udeid base is the headquarters of Central Command, which is the most important military base of the United States in all of the Middle East. With an area of responsibility that includes North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia. It's hugely important. It's not in Israel. It's in jihadi Qatar, right? And when Israel attacked a few Hamas leaders in Doha, the capital of Qatar, Trump had a gigantic Olympic tantrum, right? He was very upset about it. And he had his slave Netanyahu call the Emir of Qatar and apologize, which Netanyahu did because he's a good slave. Okay? And after that, Trump announced that he was giving Qatar NATO-level protection, meaning that if anybody attacks Qatar, the United States is going to interpret that as an attack against the United States. Not content with that, Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Defense, U.S. Secretary of Defense, announced that in this Air Force base in Idaho, I forget what the Air Force base is called, they're going to be training the Qatari Air Force. How about that? Well, so it's easy to make the case that Qatar is the most intimate ally of the United States, and Qatar is one of the most important sponsors of international jihadi terror.
It makes so much sense, so more sense to have the base in Israel.
No. It only makes sense for the U.S. to have a base in Israel if you accept the mainstream story that the U.S. is Israel's best ally. But if you accept our model, it would make no sense for the U.S. to have a base in Israel. And in fact, they don't. They have their most important base in Qatar, right? Because they are pro-jihadi. And once you look at this whole picture, which really is very, very clear, then Trump's peace plan in Gaza, which was imposed the second that Israel was about to destroy Hamas, to give Hamas the coup de grace, makes perfect sense. And Trump's behavior, which we predicted, surrounding the Hamas violations of this so-called peace agreement, also makes perfect sense, right? It makes perfect sense that Trump will make excuses for Hamas and will protect Hamas, of course, while pretending to be very macho and making all these empty threats, which he never follows through on, right? All of that makes perfect sense. Once you adopt the model that the U.S. power elite, the U.S. bosses, are in fact the bosses of jihadism. And it agrees with something else that we've discussed here before, which is Enrique Pressburger's documentation. He's got a book out. Let's put it up on this. Let's put it up on the screen. Let's put it up on the screen. Hold on just a second. Do you have it or should I?
If you have it,
I'll do it. It's better. I'll do it. Okay. So if people go to Amazon, and they look for Pressburger, you spell it like this. I think it's called The Terror Job, right? In English. There it is. This book documents that international jihadi terrorism is mostly financed from Western sources. Something like 80% or more of all the money that's going to support jihadi terrorism is not coming from the jihadi states, but in fact from the United States, the European Union, the UN, a giant constellation of NGOs that launder the money coming from the CIA and so forth. So I'll give you an example that I just learned about today. I want to do a real shout out to Enrique Pressburger because he's one of our collaborators at the Management of Reality. But one of the things that I just learned today, I don't know if this is in his book, but the U.S. Inspector General, U.S. Inspector Generals are inspectors general are functionaries whose job it is to find out when corruption is going on inside the U.S. government. They're internal watchdogs of the U.S. government. And one of these inspectors general found out that USAID, I think I have it right here. Hold on. Let me see. I think I have it right here. Yes, right here. No, that's not it. Okay, well, we'll put it in the description. But what they found was that via USAID, there was an NGO that was giving US government money to Al-Jolani in Syria. Okay, I don't know how much money, because they may have, it's quite possible that there are other conduits in addition to this one that nobody has discovered yet. But this one was discovered, and it was worth $9 million of USA supposed charity money, right, for refugees and so forth in Syria. But in fact, the NGO was giving that money, that USAID money, which is in reality CIA money, to Al-Jolani, to Al-Jolani, the guy that Trump has now installed as the new government of Syria. Okay, so that's just as an example of what Enrique Pressburger is talking about, right? There's a giant constellation of NGOs that launder the money of the clandestine services and direct it, disguised as charity, to these jihadi terror organizations. All right, so the entire picture is consistent. The entire picture is consistent. The Western governments are not our friends. The Western bosses are not our friends. They are managing an entire jihadi system, the purpose of which is to destroy Western civilization as we know it and replace it with Islamic civilization, because the great benefit of replacing Christians with Muslims is that Muslims behave like good slaves. They don't ask for democracy. They understand that they're supposed to be living in a theocracy, and that whatever the caliph says goes, right? So that's what they want. They're gonna replace Christians with Muslims. And then, of course, the King of England will announce that he has converted to Islam, and he will become the new caliph. This is the kind of transition that they're preparing. In fact, there's a couple of articles that we will put in the description by Daniel Pipes, talking about all kinds of rumors that have been going on in Britain for a long time, according to which Prince Charles, now King Charles, a long time ago converted to Islam. And he lays out all the evidence supporting this, which is circumstantial evidence, but it's dramatic. King Charles has long been the main patron of Islamic studies in Great Britain. And he never misses an opportunity to say how wonderful and how beautiful and how peaceful Islam supposedly is. He's a big enthusiastic supporter of Islam. This shouldn't really be that surprising, because in Great Britain, as we know from recent scandalous news items, people are going to jail for posting tweets critical of Islam. And meanwhile, we have these Muslim Pakistani rape gangs, they call them grooming gangs, that have been raping adolescent white girls in Great Britain with impunity. The British authorities knew this was going on for decades. We're talking about thousands of white adolescent British girls raped by these monsters, and British authorities were doing nothing. So Muslims can rape, and non-Muslims can't even post a tweet critical of Islam or of Muslim immigrants. Well, that's consistent, and they've been having Sharia courts in Great Britain for some time now. It's all consistent with the idea that the British government is being run by covert Muslims, right? This is not a crazy idea. So I think that's where the system is going.
Where are you seeing in the next few years that Europe, Britain, France, Spain, where are they going?
Well, as I've said in a video that actually went viral on Instagram, I'm expecting civil wars in Europe very, very soon, perhaps before 2026 is over, perhaps earlier, perhaps before 2025 is over. I don't know. I don't know when they're going to happen, but very soon. If they happen, you know, in 5 or 10 years, I think Westerners are going to lose them. We have a chance of winning them if they happen very soon. If they happen in a year or two, then we may win them. But it's a difficult situation for Europeans because the governments, as we've been saying, are on the side of jihadis. So I think what they need to do is replace their governments first. I mean, if you want to win against the Muslim invasion of Europe, you really need to have the organs of state on your side. Otherwise, if you're fighting the jihadis and the organs of state at the same time, I don't think you have a prayer. So the order that makes sense to me is that people should kick out of government these pro-jihadi fake Westerners who are running these countries, people like Macron and Starmer and other people running these European countries, and what's his name, Sanchez in Spain and so forth. And once they do that, then they have a prayer. Then they have a chance. I think a good chance, actually, if they do that first. If not, it's a really difficult situation. So this is what's coming. This is what's coming for the West.
Okay. That's a good point to sum up.
Yes, I think we shouldn't stop there. We should end on a note of hope, because in fact, we can win. We can win. Muslims are still a minority in the West. If Westerners wake up, they are the overwhelming majority still all over the West. And there is a theater of democracy that we can use to our advantage in order to replace these no good bosses with people who actually are patriotic Westerners. And we have a communications revolution that makes it possible for you and I are using that revolution right now. And it makes it possible for Westerners if we really try hard and join forces with all of our Western brethren, it's possible for us to communicate with each other and go around the mainstream Western media, which is obviously controlled, and wake up the entire West and get it to move for self-defense, right? This is possible. But we need to really all of us wake up and start working for that end. We need the help of all of you. We can win.
Share
is running out. Yeah. People have to share this video, share our other videos, share the articles.
Subscribe, like it, and
subscribe, like.
And I show you here our website.
Yeah, and come to our community in school.
Yeah, it's mainly for Spanish speakers, but they can come too. We have content in English.
That's right. I forget about that. I always forget.
Yes.
Right.
But what I want to show you is, like, you can come here to managementofreality.com and you go here to donations. And there are many ways for you to contribute, from $50 to more. And that would be...
Ideally, it'll be a monthly subscription so that you become a regular contributor to the cause. And the more you give us, the more people we can reach. Think about it that way. It's a way of helping us reach Westerners everywhere with material that is indispensable for the defense of the West, because it's impossible for Westerners to defend themselves if they don't know who the enemy is, if they don't know how the enemy works, right? So if you make a contribution, you will be making, you will be putting your grain of sand, and hopefully in maybe a few grains of sand, if you can afford it, to help us reach many, many more people. So anyway, let's end on that note. We can win. We just have to, we just have to do it. We have to fight for the West.
We have to fight. And we need to stand up and...
That's right. We need to stand up and fight. So make sure that you do whatever is within your power to do. If you have money, give us money. If you don't have money, share. Have conversations with the people around you. Show them the articles. Make sure that you're doing something, because the future is going to catch up to us all, and it's going to catch up to us soon. So make sure you're doing something, and that you don't look back a few years now from now and you say, oh, we were warned and I didn't do anything. You don't want to be one of those people. You want to take responsibility for your future, for the future of your children, your grandchildren. We want to leave them a Western world that is still a peaceful world, a world of democracy, of human rights, of parliament, of political participation, and so forth. Thank you very much, and we will see you on our next live. Bye-bye.
Thank you.